and she had met him at the colliery gates. He apologised for pressuring her into the drink, and he promised he would help her set it right again. As they sat in the back of the cold taxi, she had kissed him for reassurance. Her loose tongue felt bloated and lifeless, and Eugene hoped the lager on her breath was only the dregs of the night before. As her head lolled in the taxi, he had remembered then. She had not drunk any lager with him at the golf club. After that night, Shuggy had expected Eugene to flee. Instead, the boy sat in his school uniform at the telephone table and listened to them talk in the mornings Eugene came to visit. Shuggy unfolded his homework on his lap and signed her name carefully with the old biro. He remembered a time in Lizzie's house when he had played with one of his mother's Capodimonte knockoffs. The ornament was a romantic farm boy. He was wielding a blunt scythe and staring with such a strange, wistful look that he must have been witness to the most glorious sunset. Repeatedly, Agnes had asked Shuggy to leave the boy alone, but he found he could not. And when she was in her Sunday bath, he dropped it, and the arm broke from the body and the scythe smashed from his hand. Shuggy had hidden the statue in the dark of Lizzie's airing cupboard. He sat next to the heat of the immersion boiler and tried to stick the arm back on with everything from sellotape to congealing rice pudding. He visited the broken boy every day for a week and prayed for some miracle. When he wasn't in the airing cupboard, he obsessed about it. And when he was in the cupboard, he cried for what he had done. It was a whole week of torture before he panicked and just left it there, hidden between a set of old bath towels for someone else to find and repair. Shuggy sat at the telephone table and thought about the broken ornament again. He listened to them talk in the quiet voices adults used in the morning, and he could tell Eugene was tired from his night shift. The man had a wallpaper book, and he was asking what pattern Agnes preferred, the happy field flowers or the bold Bengal stripes with tiny fleur-de-lis. From the telephone table, Shuggy could tell his mother was hushed with a sore head and concentrating all her energy as she fried liver for Eugene's breakfast.
"It's nae bother," said Eugene, quite happily. "I can do the whole kitchen in a day. My father once taught me a recipe for that mould. I can scrub the walls in the morning and paper in the afternoon. It'll be brand new in no time."
"Yes, okay then," said Agnes in a tiny voice.
"You all right?"
"Yes," she said. "Just a wee sore head."
Shuggy could hear Eugene close the heavy wallpaper book. He could imagine him laying his hands palm upwards and open on the top of it.
"You know, maybe don't take a wee drink today. How about if you feel it coming on, you could go for a wee walk or something?"
Shuggy listened to his mother struggle to keep her voice even and flat. Like a skelpy piece of wood, she sanded at it to hone the roughness of sarcasm from it.
"A wee walk. Yes, maybe that would sort it."
A few weeks later, by the time the wallpaper was hung, Shuggy noticed Eugene had stopped saying things like this. He acknowledged instead that if Agnes needed to take a drink, would she at least please stop hounding the taxi rank for him? Shuggy sat at the telephone table again and took her dog-eared phone book onto his lap. He took the chewed biro, and finding Eugene's name, he changed the 6 in his telephone number to an 8. Then he found the listing for his taxi rank and changed all the 1s to 7s, as skillfully as he could. When he looked up, Eugene was standing in the kitchen doorway with a Phillips head screwdriver in his hand. Shuggy watched him go up and down the hallway and tighten all the door hinges till they shrieked against the wood.
"I was just thinking," he said to her. "The taxi needs to go into the garage next week, so I'll have a few evenings free. How about a wee night out? Our actual night time, this time. Maybe we could go back to the golf club and have that prawn cocktail you liked so much. I was thinking this time I wouldn't have a bevy. Maybe this time nobody needs to have a drink."
Shuggy took his dirty tea mug and slid past Eugene into the kitchen. His mother was sat at the table, her head in her hands, her fingers scouring her skull with a bucket between her knees. The new wallpaper was lovely. The yellow and blue field of flowers really cheered up the small space. Eugene had been very clever and neat in how he had lined up all the little bluebells. All the mould was gone, but now when Shuggy looked out the window, the brown marsh stood out like an enormous square stain in an otherwise pretty spring field. Now Shuggy crouched outside the McAvenney's and poured the remainder of the Hogmanay lager into the dead grass. He hid the empty can inside his shirt for shame. Half stunned, he crossed the street and found the front door ajar and all the house lights still burning. He wandered from empty room to empty room in disbelief, still expecting to find her somewhere. He raked through the empty kitchen cupboards and found the last tin of custard. He opened it and dipped his spoon in deep. The sugary cream made the lager in his belly stop rolling around. He sat down on the low coffee table and greedily spooned the custard down as the happy revelers in George Square started to come on the television. By the time the Kayleigh band was in full swing, he knew she would not be coming home. The revelers start to hug one another and break into song. He felt like a baby to miss his mother. It wasn't fair the way everyone could up and leave as they pleased. Shuggy searched the house for a note or a sign, a treasure map to where she had gone. But there was nothing. He searched her black bingo bag and found all the markers there. He went to the wee phone table in the hall and thought about whom he could call. The red leather address book by the phone listed all the people Agnes knew. She had been religious about keeping it updated, and some of the names in the book had been crossed out in what looked like anger. Next to her neat cursive, she had scrawled in another hand, one that looked like another woman's entirely, a short comment. Nan Flanagan still owes my mammy £5 from 1978. And Anne-Marie Easton, two-faced whore. And Davy Doyle wore a navy suit to my daddy's funeral. And Brendan McGowan only wanted a slave and a housekeeper. There were many first-name-only entries in the book. Shuggy guessed that most of them came from the AA. Some numbers gave additional descriptive information, a way to tell one Elaine from another Elaine. Shuggy thought it was funny how AA members did this. Maybe it was to protect anonymity, family names being private. But more likely, it was because people came and went, and descriptions were better than names. He flicked through pages of names he recognised. Monday to Thursday, Peter. Big Bald Peter, Mary Doll, Jeanette Mary Doll's pal, Kathy from Cumbernauld, and wee Ginger Jeannie, which was confusingly under G instead of J. That irritated him. His mother could be anywhere, and he started to panic that he might not see her till February. He screamed at the thick book. Where the fuck are you? Tell me! New Year's in Scotland was a legendary two-day party. New Year's in Agnes's Glasgow was endless. When they first came to Pithead, the boy had seen a house party that had lasted for days. Agnes had still been drunk by the 6th. By the time Shuggy was getting dressed in his school uniform, ready for the spring term, Leek had decided enough was enough. Leek could bear a lot, but on the 6th of January, he rampaged through the house with a black bin liner and pulled two ratty miners out onto the frozen street. Shuggy wondered about Leek, about his screaming, flashing gambling machines, and his insides hardened. He was getting sick of playing You Touched at Last with his brother. Picking at his bottom lip, he idly lifted the phone receiver and sniffed at the sour smoke and the perfume of her lipstick that still hung on the mouthpiece. For comfort, he held the beige handset
and listened to the hum of the dial tone. He looked at the keypad, and finally noticing the red redial button, he pressed it. The phone chirruped for a long time before someone answered. Shuggy could barely hear the woman on the other end for the din of loud old-fashioned music in the background.
Hello? Hello? Who is this?
She shouted, her voice thick with smoke and slow with drink.
Is my mother there?
He asked, now sitting erect.
Who is this?
She sounded bothered by the interruption.
Who's your mammy, wee man?
My mother is Agnes Campbell Bain, he said. Can you tell her it's Hugh?
He caught himself.
Can you please tell her I don't have any custard left?
The woman leaned back into the noise of the party.
Oh, does anybody here know an Agnes?
She asked of the room behind her. There were other voices, and then she said,
Hold on a wee minute, pal. Happy New Year, okay?
Before he could reply, she had set the receiver down. He could hear men and women laughing in the background, and could tell they were old, because the melancholy Scott songs were already playing. Shuggy waited and listened a long time for the woman to come back. He was sure she had forgotten him when a voice spoke.
Shh. Hello?
Slurred the familiar voice.
Mammy, it's me.
The voice didn't speak for a while, and when it did, it sounded confused.
What do you want? What time is it? When are you coming home? What time is it?
Shuggy peered around the corner, and in the light from the telly could just about see the face of the little clock.
10:30. No, it's almost 11 o'clock.
The voice went quiet. He heard the flare of a lighter as she sucked on her cigarette.
Well then, you should be in your bed. When are you coming home? Look, don't upset yourself. Doesn't Mammy deserve a party? It's been that long, Hugh.
Her voice trailed off.
I've been promised that many parties in my day. Why are you trying to ruin my party?
She was repeating herself now.
Mammy, I'm scared. Where are you? I'm up at Anna O'Hanna's. Away to your bed, and I'll see you when I get home.
This part was ominously vague. The line went dead, and it took him a while to replace the receiver. Shuggy thought about calling again, but she wouldn't come back to the phone. He sat there sniffing the receiver a while longer, and then he went to bed, still fully dressed with the bedroom lights on and the Hogmanay celebrations still blaring on the television. There were happy voices out in the street. He could hear the McAvenny children run up and down the road shouting, Happy New Year! At the top of their lungs. They had a wooden football clapper that they were twisting into a roaring din. He got up and went back to the phone table. Shuggy looked under A, then under O, and there she was, Anna O'Hanna. He had heard the name before. Anna wasn't from the AA. She was a childhood friend who was or was not also a distant relative. They'd once worked together in the STV canteens and gone to the Tollcross dancing together in their youth. She was, by his mother's own handwriting, an old backstabbing slitty-eyed gossip and also the best friend I ever had. Under her name was her address, marked as Germiston. He had no idea what Germiston was, but everyone Agnes ever knew lived in Glasgow, so he hoped Germiston would be there. Shuggy ripped a blank page from the back of his mother's phone book and copied the address as neatly as possible. Then he called a number he found in the phone book under Taxi.
Hello, Max Hux, said the gruff man.
Hello,
Can you tell me where Germiston is, please?
It's in the northeast, pal. Do you want a taxi?
He replied impatiently.
Sorry to bother you again, said the boy politely. But how much does a taxi to there cost?
Where are yous coming, Frey? Sighed the man.
Shuggy answered the man very specifically, giving the house number, the street, the town, and even the postal code.
About £8, plus £2.50 extra for being the New Year's.
Okay, one taxi, please, said Shuggy, hanging up the phone.
With a butter knife, he pried open the gas meter the way Jinty had shown them. Carefully, he counted out the 50 pences, lining them up neatly on the table in front of the telly. There were only 20 of them, which, without counting on his fingers, he knew was 10 whole pounds. The boy got the long, flat bread knife from the kitchen and began prying the back of the telemeter open the way he had seen Agnes do it 100 times before. With practice, he knew he had to jostle it so that the coins would fall out without damage to the meter itself. If the teleman saw the meter was broken, you would be in big trouble. But everyone on the street had so many years of practice that no one ever seemed to get into this big trouble. Shuggy had watched Agnes and then Leek raid the telemeter on a regular basis. You had to fill the meter with a 50 pence piece for 3 hours of telewatching. When the money ran out, the telly automatically switched off, leaving you in darkness. There was no negotiating till the end of a film or till the advert break. If your money was up, the telly went black. Shuggy slid the butter knife into the slot and 2 lonely 50 pences rolled out. If the man had told the truth, that should be enough to get him to Germiston, but not enough to get him back. When he heard the idling sound of the hackney, Shuggy went outside. All the house lights of the street were on, and happy families were spending the bells together. Colleen was alone at her window, watching her children run up and down the road rattling their noisemakers. Shuggy did as Agnes taught him, and so he waved and smiled as he got into the hackney. The taxi driver was a thin, fair-haired man. He was taken aback to see a child dressed as a Chicago gangster.
"You it, wee man?" he asked, puzzled.
"Yes."
He handed the driver the handwritten address. The driver lowered his head and peered at Shuggy's front window for a sign of an adult, a mother or father, to appear at the living room window. Shuggy took the plastic bag full of coins out of his pocket and placed it on his knee. All that silver made a sparking noise, and eyeing the small boy and then the money, the driver finally took the handbrake off with a huff. The taxi pulled out of the small, dusty scheme, and soon they were up in the dual-lane traffic and moving quickly. Shuggy knew this was the road into the city centre. He made a note of the route, checking off landmarks, preparing for the long walk back. First, they passed a secondary school, then some rugby fields, and finally the black void of a silent loch. From there, it all flew by unknown. Instead of taking the low road, the driver took a higher road, like he was turning away from the city. It looked like backcountry roads, like the city had exhausted the edge of its sprawl. The road was undeveloped. To the left were half-built barrack houses with their backs facing the traffic and tall, dark brown wooden fences, keeping in their unplanted lawns. On the right, unfolded miles and miles of fallow fields, dark and empty. The driver must have known the route well, because he kept glancing back and smiling at the boy in the white tie.
"You look very smart. Are you going to a party?"
he asked, smiling in the mirror.
"Well, kind of. I also just think it's important to always look your best."
The man laughed.
"So, where's your ma? She at this party?"
"I hope so," Shuggy muttered.
"Very grown up of you to be travelling alone at your age," he said. "I've got a wee boy about your age. You're about 12. He really likes to ride up front and play with my CB radio."
He was only 11, but he liked the comfort of the bigger number, so Shuggy didn't answer. It was funny the way you could see only the driver's eyes or his mouth in the mirror, never both at the same time.
"Do you want to ride up front with me?"
said the man's mouth in the mirror. It split into a wide smile. The taxi slowed to a stop, not at a junction or at a light, but in the middle of the wide empty road. Shuggy looked to the half-built houses on the left and the flattened fields on the right. If he was to bring her back safely, then Shuggy supposed he had no choice but to do as he was told. The man told Shuggy to get out. The front door on the left opened. There was no passenger seat on the left side of the Black Hackneys, just a carpeted floor. He stood in the carpeted enclosure amidst the evening newspapers, an old coat, and a half-eaten packet of sandwiches. Shuggy tried not to stare at the food. The bread was thick with crust, but he was so hungry he didn't care. He would have eaten it, crust and all.
"There you go. That's better, eh?"
The driver cleared his stuff off the floor and made some room for the boy. He held the sandwich in his hand.
"Would you like some?"
he said.
"It's just butter and a bit of tinned ham."
"No, thank you," Shuggy said politely, but his eyes were burning into the half-eaten piece.
"Here, take it,"
said the man, thrusting it towards him.
"I can hear your belly from here."
Shuggy took the sandwich. The bread was damp from the butter, and he tried to eat it slowly. But the lager sat sour in his stomach, and he found himself pushing in large hunks of salted ham. It was so thick and rich, it stuck to the roof of his mouth. Even kneeling, Shuggy was still not shoulder height to the seated figure. Glancing over the thick sandwich, he thought how the driver looked not at all like his father. The man's face was kinder. The edges of his eyes were creased from smiling. There was a crucifix and a silver chain around his neck, and the sight of it calmed Shuggy in an unexpected way.
"That there is the CB,"
said the driver, pointing to a handset that looked like an electric shaver. The driver switched a knob on the dial.
"There you go. You can gabber all you like if you want. It'll only be the long-haul drivers and the lonely hearts that follow them will hear you on this channel."
The man smiled at him with straight teeth, and Shuggy thought he would like Agnes to meet him, this man who gave him sandwiches. With a snap of the handbrake, the taxi took off again down the dark road. Shuggy fell back against the glass partition.
"Whoa there, wee man. Hold on to something."
With his left arm, he encircled the boy's waist, holding him tight and upright in the luggage space. They drove on farther down the unlit road. Shuggy tried not to eat the sandwich too quickly. The ham was thick and so deeply salty it tickled his gums. The man said suddenly,
"Happens more than you might think. Wayne's been left alone, that is."
He turned to Shuggy and smiled.
"I see it all the time. Mammies and daddies that desperate to go down the pub that Wayne's are fending for themselves. Poor wee things."
Shuggy finished the sandwich. He tried not to lick the butter from his fingers.
"Was that good?"
Shuggy nodded and answered politely. "Yes, thank you very much." The man's arm was still around his waist for support. The man laughed kindly.
"Thank you very much," he repeated, like an amused parrot. "You're a polite wee fella, aren't you?"
Shuggy tried not to look embarrassed. He fixed his eyes on the rearview mirror and wished Leek was here. The empty country road seemed to go on forever. He was trying to remember the things they passed. He made a list of things he saw, like in a game of Granny Went to Spain. But after 10 or 15 trees and only one traffic light, all the things looked the same, and he gave up reluctantly. Slowly, the driver's arm went lower down the boy's side. With a slow hand, he pulled the back of Shuggy's shirt from his tweed trousers and insidiously pushed his fat, warm fingers down the back of Shuggy's underpants. Without looking, Shuggy could tell the man was still smiling at him.
"Aye, you're a funny wee fell, aren't you?"
the man repeated. With a hard push, his hand reached further down inside the underpants, and he started searching the boy with his fingers. The waistband of the tweed trousers was cutting into Shuggy in the front. The strain felt like he was halving him in two, and he could have cried out for that pain alone. Still, Shuggy said nothing. The cab was rolling slower. The driver made a funny sound like he was eating hot soup through his front teeth. Headlights tore in the opposite direction. Shuggy winced at the man now. His fat fingers were pressing down into him in a strange way. The custard made a skin on top of the sour lager, and the bread swelled and expanded in his gut so that he thought he might be sick. The fingers pressed and pressed. The driver's mouth was pulled tight in a grimace. Shuggy wished for the light of some houses.
"You know, my father is a taxi driver."
The driver stopped his grimace. Shuggy kept on, trying to keep his voice casual and ignore the fingers that were searching his dirty place.
"I'm my mammy's boyfriend. He's called Eugene."
He took a shallow breath.
"He might know you."
The question shot up at the end. Slowly, the driver slipped his hand out from the back of the tweed trousers. Shuggy slid his back down the partition and set his dirty place safely on the floor of the cab. He put his fingers against his waist, and in the dark, he could feel the pink marks in his belly where the stitching cut into him. It felt like taking off school socks that were too tight, but worse. Voices crackled over the CB. Some man in a Tuchter accent was talking about floods in the Perth Road. The driver wiped his hand discreetly on his work trousers.
"So, did you have a nice Christmas?"
he asked casually, after a moment.
"Yes, thank you,"
Shuggy lied.
"Was Santa good to you?"
Christmas came from the Freeman's catalogue and was slowly paid off.
"Yes."
The black Hackney finally reached the lights of a grey, worn-down housing scheme, and the driver asked,
"Son, what did you say your daddy's name was again?"
Shuggy thought about lying.
"Hugh Bain."
Something like relief swept over the driver, and he relaxed back into his chair. When he dropped Shuggy in Germiston, it had already gone the bells. The boy offered the driver the bag of stolen 50 pences. The man looked at it closely, perhaps with pity or guilt, and said the ride was free because Shuggy had been such a good boy. The boy wished he had taken the coins. He didn't want the man to think he had liked the way his fingers had hurt him. Shuggy could feel the man watch his back as he climbed all the stone stairs to the front door in Strawnsea Street. Only when he turned around and smiled a brave smile did the driver pull away. When the taxi turned the corner, Shuggy tucked the black shirt back into the tweed trousers. He rubbed at the sourness in his gut. Each of the buildings were identical. The tenements crowded in on the narrow road and made a canyon of bricks and glass. Looking up, he noticed music and bright lights coming from a flat on the third floor. So he pressed the metal buzzer for 3R. Without anyone asking who was there, the door buzzed automatically open. The tenement close was poorly lit. Somewhere above Shuggy, loud music and happy voices bounced off the walls. Shuggy stepped inside. Any Glasgow Wayan could easily tell this was one of the poorer tenements. The 6 feet or so of decorative tiles that lined the entryway were cracked and missing. There was thickly applied council brown paint with a dirty cream stripe about adult eye level that pointed the way into the belly of the close. Every flat surface was covered in graffitied declarations of love and gang pride. From the sworn allegiance to the IRA, Chuggy could see that Germiston was certainly Catholic. As he climbed up from the mouth of the close, he could hear the party on the third floor. It sounded happy, like the night still hadn't turned sour. The boy took the steep stairs slowly, one at a time. They were hard granite that had been worn into a dip in the middle, and there was no curving banister. Instead, the stairway was built around a solid wall of poured concrete. As he climbed, he couldn't see what lay around the corner. He inched quietly upwards. As he turned the second bend, he came upon a woman and man sitting on the cold steps. They lay there rumpled, like two piles of dirty laundry. They were doing things to each other that the boy had seen before. The old woman seemed barely conscious, and the man had his hand up her skirt, touching her in her dirty place. Chuggy folded his arms over his chest and politely stepped back, away from what lay at eye level. He quietly stepped down some stairs and was almost back around the corner when the woman opened a rolling eye and noticed him. The man continued to rub at her like he was polishing a shoe.
"What are you looking at?"
she asked, gummy-lipped.
"Are you okay?"
he asked quietly.
"Is he hurting you?"
Somewhere above them a door opened, and the noise of a grand party filled the close. People were leaving.
"Could you stop that a minute, John?"
She pushed the hands away. The woman pulled her top closed and tried to bring more dignity to the scene. She lowered her eyes to the stone stairs. The drunken man continued chewing her neck regardless. Chuggy took out one of the 50 pences and put it on the woman's bare knee. Then he darted past them, climbing up towards the noise at the top of the stairs. Men and women were pouring down in their winter coats. It took quick feet and effort not to be swept back down by their clumsy legs and long jackets. He reached the third floor, and finding the door still wide open, he went in. No one stopped him as he pushed through the legs into the small hallway. No one paid any heed as he went into the main room. The room was a smaller version of the living room at home. It was covered in burgundy brocade wallpaper, and against one wall was a small electric fire with fake plastic coals throwing an orange glow into the sweaty room. In the middle of the room was a three-piece suite still covered in plastic. Around the corners were some borrowed kitchen chairs, and on these were sat men and women in their 40s and 50s, faces Chuggy had never seen before. The men sat in heavy grey suits and wide ties, and the women were done up in pretty blouses. They looked stiff, as though they had come from chapel, but wet-eyed, like they had taken too much communion wine. The record player in the corner was spinning an especially melancholy version of Danny Boy. A few older jakeys sat by it with their cans of warm beer and murdered the words in a howl, while an old woman sat teary-eyed nearby. The whole room was already sliding down the peak of the evening. He circled the room, searching from face to face for a sign of his mother. Agnes wasn't there. In the corner, near the window, sitting at a small folding table, was a young boy, much the same age as Chuggy. He had been watching Chuggy the entire time as he did a searching circle of the room. He was dressed in his good clothes, and his hair was still neat from when his own mother must have parted it earlier. As they looked at one another, Chuggy wondered whether he was lost or searching too. The boy raised his hand in a small wave, and Chuggy made to cross the room and speak to the stranger. Halfway there, he saw that on his little table sat a heaped plate of shortbread and some fizzy juice that still rolled with bubbles. Somebody here loved this other little boy. Chuggy turned away and went back to looking for Agnes. Back out in the hallway, he passed the tangle of legs once again. In the small, narrow kitchenette was a woman with jet-black hair. His heart leapt and fell as he realised it was not his mother. Shuggy thought to ask her where Agnes was, but he was so embarrassed by the little shortbread boy that he said nothing. Pride clamped his mouth shut, and the black-haired woman sailed past him like he was invisible. There were three bedrooms in the tenement flat. Each was empty, except for the odd lost partygoer having a quiet smoke or a quiet cry. He searched them all, but none of the drunks were his. The last room was the biggest bedroom, the one for mammies and daddies. The door was closed tight, and he had to pull down on the metal handle and push hard to get the sticky door open. There were no lights on in the room, but as the glow followed him in from the hallway, he could see the large double bed was heaped high in winter coats. Shuggy stood there and put his hand on the bag of coins in his pocket. It would be just enough to get him home. Perhaps he would find her there, frantic, sobered with worry, and waiting with hot tea and toast. In the smoke and the dark, tears began to sting his eyes, and he sat in the coat-covered bed for just a minute. He was being a baby, and he knew it. He had been a big baby all night, wanting his mammy, and he wished he was more like Leek, who never seemed to need anyone. Shuggy dug the nails of his left hand into the soft part of his right arm, and he willed the poor me's to stop. Something stirred under the coats. Shuggy stood up in fright. Out from some old jackets came a small white hand. It hovered for a moment before it pulled a coat away from its face, and there, with a wet face and spot mascara, was his mother. Agnes's hair was flat and matted on the right side. In the dim light, the boy could see by the smallness in her eyes that she was no longer drunk. As she looked at him, her lip trembled as if she would cry. This scared him into stopping his own sobbing, and he tried to stand up straight like a big boy. One by one, he pulled the winter coats to the floor and uncovered her. Slowly, she emerged, half naked and crumpled, from the heap. In the half dark, she held his eyes, and she didn't say a word. Slowly, he kept pulling the layers from the bed. From beneath the heavy coats emerged her white legs and small feet. Shuggy stopped and looked at her there, and in the tangle and the hallway light, he saw that her black pretty pollies had been ripped from toe to waist. Chapter 24. The boy opened his eyes, and she was there, sat quietly on the end of his bed. She was a terrible half a person that always came in the mornings now. He watched her shiver for a while, trembling with the dampness that the drink had left in her. She held a piece of toilet paper to her mouth as she coughed up wet phlegm and then tried to hold in the rattling bulk that followed. Agnes cocked her head and looked at him with pleading, sleepless eyes.
Morning, sunshine. Morning.
Shuggy stretched his toes to the end of the bed. Her hand was shaking as she gently pulled the layers of bed covers away. The damp March air rushed in, and Shuggy whined and curled up in a tight ball. Agnes reached out her cold hand and put it on his clammy foot. He had taken another stretch. The old pajamas cropped above his calves now, the hair on his legs starting to thicken and grow darker.
Another year and you'll be a man. And then what am I going to do? Do you think I will be taller than Leek? He asked.
His brother's bed was already empty.
Most definitely.
She pushed his inky hair away from his eyes and tried to sound cheery.
How'd you like to stay off the school today? Keep me company.
Shuggy's eyes flew open at the offer.
I dunno. Father Barry says I've missed too much already. Ugh, you never mind him. You went nearly every day last week. I'll write you a note saying your granny died.
Shuggy groaned and stretched his toes into the cold.
He's not daft. You've done that 3 times already.
He knew what she wanted. As soon as the clock turned 9:15, he was put out on the frozen street with the Tuesday book in his hand. He wore his thin cagoule and good trousers, and over one arm he carried a large gingham nylon shopper bag. The shopper was a decoy. There would be no groceries to put into it. But it played the part and made the whole thing look more respectable. Like a greedy bookie, Shuggy flicked the pages of the Tuesday child support book and watched the princely sum of £8.50 appear on all the dated coupons. He found the one she had signed for this week, checked to see whether she had filled it out correctly in her desperate hunger, and then he dropped it into the decoy bag. He knew she was watching from behind the net curtains, so he walked quickly and with a purpose. When he turned the corner out of sight, he slowed and spent the time squashing the white berries into a paste. Shuggy had tried it always, rushing like the clappers up the street and back or going missing for hours in the peat marshes. Once, he'd even cashed the books and spent the child support on actual messages, provisions and meat from the butcher. It always ended up the same. She returned the messages that she could and bought what she really needed first. Drink. So now, when he cashed the benefit books, he just put his head down and got on with it with a sense of resignation. She hadn't been the same since New Year's Eve. Whoever had left her half naked under the pile of strangers' coats had taken the yearning for a good party out of her. Now, when Shuggy watched her drink, he could see she had lost the taste for a good time. She was drinking to forget herself, because she didn't know how else to keep out the pain and the loneliness. The petrol station had turned her away. She had missed too many shifts, and with no one to cover, the station had gone dark too many times. At first, Agnes had taken the rejection on the nose. Like everything else, it was not meant to work out for her. When the catalogue bills started to pile up, and there was no money for drink by a Thursday, she started to talk about her sacking like it was a conspiracy. She had been too popular, too beautiful, she said, and the station owners hadn't liked how the place had turned into a social club for lonely taxi drivers. Leek had sat and listened to her, quietly spooning hot cereal into his mouth. And then he had asked, calmly, "How long are you going to keep lying to yourself?" The queue took forever. It was silent but for rattling coughs, the swish of nylon anoraks and the stamp, stamp, stamp of the agitated woman behind the counter. The way they fidgeted, he could tell that the people had waited a long weekend for their benefit books to be cashed. Some people would have been hungry, some running out of cigarettes by Sunday tea time, and others, like his own mother, were dying of a deep thirst. Shuggy pulled up to the counter and pushed the book into the little drawer that sat at eye level. With a slice, it was pulled away from him. With a slice, it came back. "You've not signed it," said the postmistress. Shuggy took the chained-down pen and wrote his name in the designee space in the way she had made him practice. He dropped it back in the drawer and smiled up at the lady. The woman took it up and looked at it closely on both sides. She wore rose-framed glasses and looked down at him like a teacher on a high stool.
"Can Mrs. Bay not come and collect her child support herself?" she asked,
a fraction too loudly. Shuggy felt the queue behind him shift impatiently from one foot to the other.
No.
The woman leaned backwards, as if stretching her tired back.
Young man, should you not be at school?
He heard the queue clear its throat in agreement.
My mother is not well,
he whispered discreetly into the drawer. The woman leaned into the safety glass, her face looming large above his.
Yes, but it comes to my mind that I see you every single Monday and Tuesday morning.
She sniffed and held up the book, putting her finger under Agnes's signature.
It says here,
she sniffed again,
that authorising a designee is only for temporary purposes, and if the person cannot claim their own benefit, then the book should be returned to the DSS.
Shuggy felt the threat of shit in his underpants. All he could manage was a quiet.
Please, missus.
Shall I take this book from you, young man?
She adjusted her glasses with an ink-stained finger.
Should I send it back to the DSS?
The boy shook his head and felt the leak start to worsen.
No, please, missus,
he begged. The woman seemed not to hear or not to care. She folded the book and put it closed on the counter. Solemnly, she folded her hands over the top of it as though in prayer. The back of Shuggy's eyeballs began to sweat. He could hear the hungry crowd start to moan.
The child benefit was more than a quarter of all the money Agnes would get to feed them for a week.
With a trembling lip, Shuggy tried again.
Please, missus.
The impatient crowd tottered and sighed behind him.
That boy's mammy is not well,
said a high voice from the very back of the post office. The postmistress looked up from the ashen face to the long queue.
Give him his money, or he'll have nothing to eat,
it said again. An old woman at the front joined in. She was tired of the wait and was shaking her pension book.
Oh, for the love. Give the boy his money, you heartless Jobsworth.
The lady behind the counter looked at the queue and down at the fearful boy. She opened the book reluctantly. Stamp, stamp. She marked it and ripped out the coupon for that week. Into the drawer, she slipped the Tuesday book. A fiver, £3 notes, and a new 50 pence piece. She held onto the drawer and leaned her face up to the little holes in the glass. Quieter now, she said.
You are a smart boy. Don't you let me catch you here again next week. Get yourself back in school. Study. Stick in at it, and don't spend your whole life in a benefits queue.
There was a pity in her eyes, and with that she sent the drawer through. The boy nodded obediently, and, licking the running wetness on his top lip, emptied the drawer of the money. He couldn't worry about next week. He'd have to worry about the rest of this week first. Shuggy had hurried towards Pithead as quickly as he could. When he passed the school, he climbed the broken fences and ran down the dirt siding into the marshlands. When he was far enough from the road, he took off his trousers and his underpants, and hunkering down, he finished what the postmistress had started. Then he turned his white underpants inside out and tried to scrape them clean on some dried reed grass. By the time he got home, it was still not 10:30 in the morning, and the street was just starting to open its curtains. He opened the front door and ran right into her, standing in the middle of the hallway. She was dressed in her best mohair coat and had lined her eyes and put a deep lavender colour on her top lids. Her hair was set and curled, and the hairspray still hung wet and sparkling on its tips like dew. Under her left arm, she had her best bag, and the other hand was out, palm side up, like a patient saint. It was itchy and red-looking.
Where the hell have you been?
She asked, wanting no reply. The boy opened the message bag and took the notes and single coin out from amongst his dirty underpants. Agnes clipped it securely into her purse.
Right. I need you to walk me up the road. If we meet anybody, I want you to talk to me.
What about?
Anything. Bloody anything.
Just talk to me and don't bloody stop, okay?
Agnes spun him around and pushed him back out the door. As they reached the corner, he could tell she was relieved they hadn't passed a soul yet. At the bottom of the hill, leaning over a garden fence, was Colleen McAvenny talking to one of her and Eugene's cousins. They were smoking cigarettes, and Colleen had two big black bin bags full of washing or sheets or the last of Big James's clothes. They looked up as they heard the rap of heels on the concrete. Agnes made an unsteady swerve, as though she were going to cross the road. But instead, she pulled her head up high and kept her path. She strutted out a confident, rhythmic clip and turned her head and said to the boy,
"What would you like for your dinner tonight?"
Shuggy looked up at his mother and did as he had been taught.
"Roast chicken, please. I'm a bit tired of sirloin every other night."
They passed the women, who stopped their own conversation, and Agnes said with a light laugh,
"Oh, you will have steak again and be thankful."
She turned her regal profile and held her raw hand behind herself.
"Oh, hello, Colleen. Hello, Molly. This one is growing like a weed."
The women said nothing as she passed, but she felt them draw their eyes over the coat, over the shoes and hair. When she was safely past them, her face froze in a rictus and she muttered,
"Aye, seem to you cunts,"
and then crossed the street. Dolan's general shop sat at the end of a row of three boarded-up shop fronts, perched at the top of the hill that overlooked all of Pithead. When the colliery was still open, it would have been a busy place, meeting the family's needs with fresh vegetables, the best meat, and a place to pass bits of talk. Now Mr. Dolan didn't even turn on the lights. If the other nearest shop hadn't been over 2 miles away, then Dolan's might have closed altogether. As though admitting this half-defeat, the shop sat with its metal shutters closed and the lights always off, only daylight pouring through the bill-posted front door. Mr. Dolan himself was a kind and gentle man, although the sight of him scared Shuggy. When the shopkeeper was a boy and the mine was still open, he fell out of a yew tree and crushed his right arm so badly they had to amputate it. Now every time a wain climbed a fence, mammies hung out windows and screamed,
"Get doing off of that or you'll end up like poor Mr. Dolan."
As the shop bell rang, Mr. Dolan looked both happy and sad to see Agnes. The racks of lager cans and whiskey bottles behind him said he well understood the new economy of the scheme. Yet, when the beautiful woman came up to the counter, the one-armed man couldn't help but sigh at the waist. Agnes, trying to ignore the pity in his face, asked the shopkeeper how he was today. Mr. Dolan just shrugged and nodded towards the boy.
"Why, you know, in school?"
"He's got a wee bug, Mr. Dolan," Agnes interjected. "It's been going around."
The old man sucked his teeth, but didn't linger on the lie. Agnes took out a piece of paper on which she had written a short message list. She ordered some innocent provisions: tin custard, tinned peas, some mince, and a handful of potatoes. She asked for a little sliced ham and fidgeted nervously as Mr. Dolan moved the meat skillfully in the slicer using his half stump. The butt end of cured pig and the pink puckered edge of his stump looked to be one and the same.
"How much is that to be?"
she asked, as he put the slices of gammon into her message bag.
£5.02, said the man.
Agnes fumbled for a moment.
Can I also have the day's paper, please?"
£5.27.
"Wee bar of that Cadbury's for the boy?"
£5.50.
Let's see, said Agnes, in a fake forgetful tone. Oh, aye, I nearly forgot. Shuggy looked at his feet in shame. Can I have 12 special brew, please? When the man turned to reach these from the shelf, Agnes licked all the lipstick off her bottom lip.
£13 even, the man said.
Agnes opened her purse and looked down at the notes and the single silver coin. Oh, Mr. Dolan, seems I'm a wee bit short the day.
The one-armed man reached under the counter and pulled out a big red ledger. He thumbed through the pages to B and found Agnes's name.
Hen, you already owe me £24,
he said with gravity.
I can't give ye any more tick till that's all paid.
With a pained smile, Agnes looked through the message bag and placed the gammon, the tinned peas, and 2 potatoes back on the counter. Whatever Mr. Dolan thought, he never said. As terrifying as his loose sleeve was to the boy, Shuggy knew that he was a deeply sympathetic man. All the mothers in the scheme called him the one-armed bandit on account of his high prices. But Shuggy had never seen him be anything but kind. As Agnes stood shaking before him on a Tuesday morning, she looked as though she were shopping in the West End at the big brand name shops. Mr. Dolan never called out her little charade. Sometimes, when she was pulling food back out of the bag, he would wink at the polished boy with his hair washed and parted and would slide him a piece of ripe fruit. But not today. Today, he took back nearly all the groceries and rang up the lager for Agnes. Agnes clipped through the scheme with the message bag by her side. She glided faster now, and Shuggy struggled to keep up as she flew down the hill. When she got home, she went into the kitchen without taking off her coat. Shuggy sat in the living room and let her gather herself. He waited for the hiss and splash of the cans and then the sound of the drink being hidden. He waited until he heard the tap running at the big metal sink.
You feeling better? He asked from the doorway.
She turned from the tea mug. The nervousness from her face was gone, but the worry was still there.
Much better, thanks. You were a good wee helper the day.
He went and wrapped himself around her waist.
I'd do anything for you.
All the way across the peat marsh, he kept stopping and turning back to wave, until the house dropped out of sight and he couldn't see her at the window anymore. As he cracked his way across the frozen burns, he consoled himself, knowing exactly what her day looked like. There was comfort in the fact that whether sober or not, it largely followed the same trap routine. Shuggy flicked the brittle heads of the bulrush weeds and wondered whether the sadness would get her today. The frozen reeds were bone dry, and when he tapped the heads, their seeds took to the air like little parachutists. They floated up and back to the scheme like a parade of little ghosts. He made a game of telling the ghosts that he loved her, and with a flick he sent them her way. The trampled grass circle, where he practiced being a normal boy, was exactly as he had left it. On days when she had kept him home from school, he had collected old bits of abandoned furniture for his flattened island. When she had a particularly bad bender, he spent a whole schoolless week taking an old chair over, some carpet scraps from the bins, and odd pieces of cutlery and broken china. With ends of old rope, he pulled things out of the rusty burns. He pulled out a broken telly and sat it facing the centre of the island. Even though it had no screen, just having it there made it feel more like a home. When he had all the furniture he wanted, he spent any dry days arranging and then rearranging the stuff into a shabby front room. He found an old-fashioned baby carriage and pushed it around, struggling through the long reeds, collecting the prettiest flowers for his new home.
when he found a little black rabbit, dead and frozen one winter afternoon. He washed it in the burn and buried it in the dirt. Then he had buried the plastic ponies next to the rabbit, the shameful scented horses that he had stolen, but that were not meant for boys. The following spring, he searched the slag bins and took to laying sprigs of purple helleborine on the graves. With no friends to speak of, these little rituals occupied him well, allowing him to spend the day feeling house proud, to attend to the shameful hummocks as dutifully as any mourning widow. All that short day, he walked around his trampled island washing the dirt off things. He took the fork, the spoon, and the cracked plates down to the burn and rinsed them in the water. He lifted the bits of carpet and tried to shake the stour from them. Then he hung the rain-soaked blanket over a chair to warm and crack in the low sun. The sun was already leaving the sky after a short day's housework. As he climbed through the back fence, he hoped to take a deep bath and practice his red book. But the front door was hanging wide open. Shuggy stood frozen on the bottom step for a long while, wondering what the omen was, tilting his head and listening like a guard dog. Creeping up the long hallway, he could hear commotion from inside the living room. He walked cautiously to the door and pushed it open a crack. Inside, prostrate on the floor was Agnes. Sat on her chest like a school bully was Leek. The crimson swirls on the red carpet were wrong. The pattern looked broken and disjointed. As Shuggy stepped closer, he could see that there was blood in his mother and that there was blood in Leek's face too. If he could have focused, he would have seen that there was also blood in the TV and the brown table and the fringe of the settee. Leek was pushing down onto the heap of her. Around them were bloody piles of fabric that had once been clean tea towels. Agnes was writhing and cursing under Leek's weight. She called him names that Shuggy had never heard before, and his brother was crying strange tears and struggling to hold her down. There was a broken razor blade on the carpet. To Shuggy it was small and thin and innocent-looking, like a tiny guillotine for a cartoon mouse. He only noticed it because it was funny that it should be in the living room, lying in the middle of his mother's good carpet. Leek was screaming something at him, but Shuggy couldn't understand. He wanted to know why there was blood in her tea mug. He watched his brother twist his face towards him as he held blackening tea towels over Agnes's wrists. When he had one of her arms secure under his knee, he reached out and grabbed Shuggy by the shirt front. Agnes's other arm flew free, and there was a low spurt of blood. Shuggy wanted to tell Leek, "Look, look, that is where the blood is coming from." But Leek had him by the collar and was shaking him so hard he thought his neck might snap.
"Shuggy, listen to me!"
Leek's eyes were very white, and there was white foam in the corners of his mouth. His face was coated in the thick white dust of a plasterer, and there was blood in the white of his teeth.
"You need to call a fucking ambulance."
"You're a selfish cunt,"
she wailed.
"Just let me go."
Her body was racked with deep sobs. Leek's tears were falling onto her face and mixing with her own.
"I'm too tired."
Still, she pushed and she heaved, and then her eyes rolled backwards as though they were looking for the relief of sleep.
"You don't love me. You don't love me,"
she repeated again and again. The boy pulled the door quietly closed behind him. He sat down and composed himself before he called 999 and asked for an ambulance. Leek was screaming something at him, but he didn't understand. He didn't understand any of it. When Agnes awoke in the psychiatric hospital, she had no memory of getting there. The ambulance had taken her the many miles to the Royal Infirmary in the shadow of Sight Hill. One of the emergency doctors skillfully stitched her wounds and stopped her blood loss. Then they put her on a drip and sedated her to keep her from clawing at herself again. As she rolled into a fitful sleep, they had admitted her to Gart Naval to begin the deeper healing. When she woke, she was in a ward with 13 other women. Grown women, dribbling on themselves. Poor women, crying at dollies to get dressed for school. Sedated women, who didn't ever sleep a wink. As Agnes, tiny and stitched up, slept through her sedation, Leek and Eugene drew the curtain against the unfortunates and stood sentinel on either side of her bed. It was the most time they had ever spent together. Each man was glad, in some way, to have this dormant body between them to focus on. It was a relief in the same way old people enjoyed having a child in the room, because it gave them something to fuss over when they had nothing left to say to each other. Leek had not spoken to Eugene since the man had goaded Agnes into breaking her sobriety. Now, they spent most of that first afternoon warily engaging with each other, avoiding eye contact, and talking about Agnes as though the other man had never met her. They agreed on only one thing. They looked down at the wrung-out woman and agreed how lucky she was to have survived. From the long, deep cuts on her wrists, it was clear she hadn't wanted to leave anything to chance.
"So it was the foreman, then?" asked Eugene, unable to meet Leek's clear gaze.
"Uh-huh. Lucky that. Suppose. I don't know how many times she'd phoned that day. She'd been calling my work a lot lately. Aye. My taxi rank as well."
Leek hunched his shoulders, like he sat heavy under the memory of it all.
"It was a brass neck, but the gaffer was usually pretty good about it. Except this one time, he came over and told me personally that I'd better get home fast. There was some sort of emergency."
"He tell you that?"
Leek nodded.
"I had my jacket in his hands, and at first I thought I was getting the sack. Then he told me to hurry. He even gave me money for a taxi."
Leek brushed the hair back over his eyes.
"That's how I knew something bad must have happened."
When Agnes finally woke up, it took a while for the realization of what she had done to sink in. First, she smiled at them as if they had brought her morning tea. Clouds of memory passed over her, and then she looked down and saw her bandaged wrists. She had come closer this time than ever in the past. Leek's construction site was on the south side. She hadn't meant for him to make it. She hadn't known the gaffer was a good-hearted man.
"Where's the Wayne?"
she asked, her voice cracked with dryness. Leek looked at her and then, for the first time, he looked at Eugene.
"He's okay," said Leek.
Agnes's eyes swiveled without her moving her head.
"I asked where, not how."
The blackness in her dilated pupils pinned him to the wall. Leek looked away and tried to busy himself with something to soothe her thirst. He poured her a phosphorescent glass of diluting juice, but she held her hand out in refusal. He looked at his shoes.
"Well, he's with Big Shug,"
Leek said finally, wishing in that instant that he had lied. Agnes did not say anything. She thought he was lying. The way her top lip curdled and stuck to her teeth warned Leek to stop taking the piss.
"Before you cut yourself, you must have phoned him and told him to come get Shuggy. It all happened that fast. I couldn't help you and help Shuggy."
Leek exhaled upwards, and his fringe rippled like a curtain in an open window.
"It's too much, Mammy. I can't be the one to save everybody all the time."
Chapter 25. By the time Agnes awoke in Gart Naval Hospital, her boy had been living at his father's almost a week. Before she cut herself, she had called the taxi rank to declare that Shug had finally gotten his wish. She was leaving them all for good, and that he should come collect his winnings, the boy. She said that she had bought a new suit for Shuggy from the catalogue, and that Shuggy was to wear black dress socks to her funeral, that Shug would need to be vigilant about that. Leek never knew how that message got to Shug. Did the Hackney dispatcher broadcast it over the CB radio for all to hear? Did all the black Hackneys pull to the curb and idle their engines as Joni Micklewhite relayed the last wishes of the woman she had helped kill? Shug had not bothered to rush. When he finally came to Pithead, he was impressed that Agnes had actually gone through with it. He found the boy eating tinned peaches, sitting stunned on the bloody settee, consoling a wet-faced Shona Donnelly from upstairs. Shuggy had never been to his father's new house before. As the taxi chugged heavily through echoing streets, the boy counted on his fingers and realised he had spent less than 3 hours with his father since Joni Micklewhite had stolen him away. He sat in the back of the black Hackney as good as a stranger. He couldn't really remember meeting Joni Micklewhite either, but he could remember the yellow roller boots with a traitor's cramp that hurt his heart. Joni had become like a villain in his mind. Her reality and her legend were mixed deep inside him. Agnes's hate for her was as ingrained in him as knots in wood. So Shuggy sat in stilted silence as a taxi rounded the corners of a brutal-looking council scheme. Each street was a scarred field of burnt-out off-licences, dirty canals and cars on bricks. To the boy, this place looked a little like Sight Hill. 5 or 6 tall high-rises pinned the heavy winter sky in place. Yet, unlike in Sight Hill, the high-rises were ringed at the bottom with low, boxy concrete houses instead of flat, empty forecourts. These low houses looked like ants gathered around trees, or scraps made of the council breeze blocks left over from the high-rises. What was once built to be new and healthful now looked sick with a poverty of hope. There was no grass and no greenery. Every flat surface was concreted over or covered in large, smooth, round boulders. Big Shug stopped the engine at a vandalised telephone box. Shuggy could tell from the back of the taxi that it was a difficult conversation. It looked difficult, because after Shug hung up, he stood in the phone box for a long time, smoothing his moustache. The boy opened the suitcase Shug had made him pack. Into it, he had put all the possessions that meant most to him, and very few clean clothes. He took out a faded Polaroid. It showed a shirtless Shug holding him as a newborn in one proud outstretched hand and smoking an ashy doubt in the other. He checked it now against the man in the phone box. On dreich days, Shuggy would take Agnes's wedding album and hide at the foot of her bed, poring over the photos of his father. Shug didn't look like the person he remembered from the 3 Polaroids taken at the wedding reception. He looked smaller than the smiling man who had sat in the banquette with his arms flung open around drunken bridesmaids. Now the years of sedentary taxi driving had taken what was already average and also made it round. The short Caesar cut of the photos was replaced by a wispy comb-over. The one's cheeky eyes were set deeper into his pink flesh. Shuggy couldn't imagine any woman wanting to slow dance with this man now. Shug hadn't really looked at the boy until he was in the back of the taxi and they were already on the north side. He climbed back into the driver's seat and turned and looked at the mud and dirt and blood in the boy's school uniform. He asked Shuggy whether he had any cleaner clothes to change into. The boy said he had no clean clothes, but he did have pyjamas. It was a shameful feeling,
taking off your clothes in front of a strange